Chapter 22. Some 700 miles east of Mecca, in the palm-fringed oasis sandwiched between the gravelly desert and the Persian Gulf, another uprising was starting in these hours, fueled by decades of resentment at Saudi government policies and ignited by revolutionary fires that raged across the water in Iran. Coastal towns such as Qatif, Safwa, and Sayat were the bastions of the kingdom's 350,000-strong Shiite minority. Though a fraction of the overall Saudi population, these embittered Shiites constituted a majority in the kingdom's vast eastern province, home to almost all Saudi oil. At the time, they also accounted for more than a third of the workers at the company that extracted this oil, Aramco. Ever since conquering Arabia's eastern coast in 1913, the Saudi state had relegated the Shiite community to impoverished ghettos. Though Shiite towns and villages literally sat atop the oil fields that provided Saudi Arabia with newfound wealth, they remained excluded from the ambitious development projects that transformed the rest of the kingdom. It was not just that the area's oil brought few benefits to the locals. Aramco's practice of filling oil wells with water pumped from the Shiite oases' underground aquifers had led to an ecological disaster. The lowering of the water table made irrigation canals go dry, replacing with dusty shrub much of the region's once luscious vegetation. Discrimination against the Shiites wasn't limited to distributing oil funds. Deemed heretics, if not outright infidels, they were excluded from senior Saudi government jobs and the military. In government-run schools, Shiite children were taught that their sect of Islam was a devilish Jewish invention that aimed to undermine the true faith. Shiite-cooked food was deemed unclean. And, crucially, their custom of mourning processions during the main Shiite religious festival, the Ashura, was prohibited by the state. Ashura, which falls on the 10th day of the month of Muharram, commemorates the martyrdom of Hussein, the son of Ali and grandson of Prophet Muhammad. The tragedy of Hussein's death in the Battle of Karbala, against vastly larger Sunni forces, defines the Shiites' millennial sense of having been wronged by the Sunni majority of the Muslim world. In traditional blood-soaked Shiite processions, worshippers mourn Hussein on Ashura by beating their chests, flagellating themselves with iron chains, and even cutting their foreheads open with knives. Although Juhayman was a Sunni, his takeover in Mecca, which began on the 1st of Muharram, precisely 10 days before Ashura, reinforced the convulsions of religious fervor that usually seize Shiite lands at this time of the year. Shiites in the eastern province, unlike Wahhabi radicals in Riyadh or Medina, knew very little about Juhayman's program or ideology. Few realized that the gunmen in Mecca happened to be much more hostile to the Shiite freedoms and aspirations than the Saudi state ever was. As exciting rumors about Mecca events swept Shiite towns that week, hot-headed young radicals were awed by Juhayman's uprising, which they imagined to be an Iranian-style revolution against the House of Saud. The weakness that Saudi forces displayed in the Grand Mosque emboldened these radicals to act in their own hometowns, opening a second front of the war against the hated regime. Mujahid Juhayman, the foe of their foes, emerged for years to come as the Shiite revolutionaries' unlikely idol. Saudi security services had been fearing for months that Shiite Iran might use its religious affinity with local inhabitants to foment unrest in the eastern province. The warnings about Iranian agitation that the American Consul General in Tehran, Ralph Lindstrom, cabled to Washington on the first day of the Mecca crisis were not without foundation. The Iranians indeed ran a large network of intelligence operatives and clerics intent on destabilizing the Saudi regime. In recent days, as the Mecca crisis escalated, the tone of Iranian radio broadcasts in Arabic had become more and more shrill, urging the Saudi Shiites to rise up and overthrow the tyranny. America, whose company still played a crucial role in operating Aramco, was portrayed in these broadcasts as the community's enemy. For the first time, visible anti-American feelings swept the oil-producing areas of the eastern province, home to most of the 40,000 Americans living in Saudi Arabia. On the first day of the Mecca crisis, Aramco's security chief had already relayed to Lindstrom that Shiite activists in the area near the crucial Ras Tanura terminal had been agitating for a campaign to chase Americans from the region. Days later, at least 50 American employees of Aramco at Ras Tanura, Abqaiq, and other key Saudi oil installations received threatening letters from these Shiite revolutionaries. "You are to know that all facilities and properties for all the Americans will be destroyed," the letters promised in stilted and ungrammatical English. "We are serious and very eager to destroy you all." Corroborating these threats, the CIA picked up and passed to Crown Prince Fahd an alarming intelligence report. Shiite revolutionaries intended to blow up a major refinery in the eastern province and to score propaganda points by blaming the explosion on American mischief. The Iranians' point man coordinating subversion on the Arab side of the Gulf was Hadi Madarasi, the Iraqi-born cleric who had tried to barge into the Arab League summit in the Tunis Hilton and whose fiery sermons had already sparked Shiite unrest in the nearby island state of Bahrain. Just a few weeks before heading to Tunis, Madarasi preached in person the gospel of Islamic revolution in the Shiite prayer houses of Safwa and Qatif. Among Saudi Arabia's native Shiites, the mantle of the most senior Islamic revolutionary belonged to a Qatif-born sheikh, Hassan al-Safar. For years, Safar and other radical Saudi Shiites refined their theological acumen and political conspiracy skills at the Al-Rasul al-Azam Religious Academy in the relative safety of nearby Kuwait. It was in Kuwait that, just like Juhayman, they printed their propaganda leaflets and insurrectionary tracts. Safar, who remains the Saudi Shiites' main religious leader today, masterfully urged his people to abandon their deference to the Wahhabi regime. Like Juhayman, he blasted older clerics and notables for being unduly accommodating to the House of Saud. The excessive fear which handicaps the mind, exhausts the body, impedes the progression of energies is the illness from which the overwhelming majority of our society suffers, he proclaimed. Waiting for the danger to occur is worse than the danger itself, and thus it is better to attack the danger. Just before Muharram 1400, as Juhayman was putting in motion the takeover in Mecca, Safar sneaked back into Saudi Arabia and went on a clandestine lecture tour in the Husaniyas, Shiite temples dedicated to the mourning of Hussein, across the eastern province. In these lectures, Safar and his aides compared the Shiite community's current predicament with the Battle of Karbala. Such a parallel inevitably turned the celebration of Ashura, a religious holiday, into an outpouring of anger against the House of Saud, seen as the modern-day incarnation of the Sunni caliphs who had martyred the beloved Hussein. It was after one of these lectures, in the Sinan Husaniya of Qatif, on the evening of November 25, 1979, that one emotional youth jumped up from the mat and shouted, "Allahu Akbar!" at the top of his lungs. As eyewitnesses remember it, hundreds of fellow young men, dressed in traditional gowns and checkered headdresses, thundered with an "Allahu Akbar!" in return. Then, they all filed out of the building, waving clenched fists and shouting revolutionary slogans. This burgeoning crowd marched to the center of Qatif, where nervous police lined up. Military presence was thin, as on this day Saudi troops were still engaged in an all-out assault of Mecca's Grand Mosque, sustaining heavy casualties. Using loudspeakers, the police declared the demonstration illegal and urged Shiite protesters to disperse. The reply was a defiant, "Allahu Akbar!" Some prominent merchants and tribal leaders, fearful that such demonstrations would backfire against the community, tried to call for calm, but they were haughtily brushed aside by the young zealots. After a tense standoff, policemen ran into the crowd, beating back the protesters with clubs. Some of the demonstrators tried to resist, hurling rocks, but had to retreat once the officers started firing volleys of tear gas canisters. Soon the clouds of gas became so thick that the rioters could no longer see one another. For that evening, the protests were over. Nevertheless, Saudi officials were badly shaken by this display of Shiite discontent. A mass-scale uprising here in the heart of the Saudi oil industry could hurt the House of Saud even more than the already unbearable trauma in Mecca. A rattled Major General Hussein Malki, the General Intelligence Directorate, GID, boss for the Eastern Province, fretted about Iranian subversion, speculating in a meeting with Consul General Lindstrom the following morning that the seizure of the Grand Mosque might have been an operation intended to divert attention from the major objective of those who might have sponsored it. Violence resumed hours later in the town of Sayat, the Shiite community closest to Damam Tahran al-Kobar, the modern, predominantly Sunni conurbation that housed provincial authorities, the American consulate, and the Aramco headquarters. Demonstrators who poured out of the Sayat Husseinia after the evening prayer were ready for battle. They carried iron bars, sticks, and stones. These presented only limited danger for government troops. Unlike Juhayman's Bedouins occupying Mecca's Grand Mosque, the urban Shiites of the Saudi East Coast possessed no military training and rarely owned firearms. Which is why, once tear gas was fired into the crowd at Sayat, some of the protesters tried to rectify the imbalance of force by grabbing weapons from the police. One of several youngsters involved in this melee was Hassan Al-Khalif, a recent graduate of Aramco's Industrial Training Center. By one account, he lunged toward a policeman's handgun. The officer proved alert and shot at Khalif. The first among many martyrs of the Shiite uprising fell dead. His body was snatched away by fellow rioters and paraded through the streets of Sayat as a rousing symbol of the crimes perpetrated by al-Saud. That night, the Saudi government grew so alarmed by the metastasizing of domestic upheaval that it began to withdraw National Guard units from Mecca, where the surface of the mosque had just been secured. Entire battalions of the guard were rushed to the rebellious Shiite province. Scarred by the ferocity of rebel fire in Mecca, many of these Bedouin troopers had been reluctant to fight their kin among Juhayman's men. But they felt no such compunction about battling the infidel Shiites of the east. Rebels of Qatif or Sayat would see no mercy. An ancient center of Gulf commerce, fishing, and the pearl trade, Qatif was a maze of narrow alleys that zigzagged among elaborate fortress-like houses made of coral and mud. It was here that the Kamarshian heretics had taken the magic black stone from Mecca more than a millennium ago. Almost completely Shiite, the town was not the kind of place the government troops would find easy to control as the uprising expanded. The morning of Wednesday, November 28th, the young men of Qatif were determined to avenge the death in Sayat. They were further inflamed by reports that some of the prominent locals had been arrested the previous night. Senior leaders of the uprising, such as Sheikh Safar, had to go into hiding, eventually fleeing across the desert to Syria. Freshly arrived National Guard troops were already deployed in large numbers, their machine guns mounted on flatbed trucks and ominously facing the city. Protesters concentrated at first on a local government headquarters, showering the building in a hail of rocks. As a ragtag column of demonstrators approached guard lines, waving portraits of Khomeini, some in the crowd tried to counter anti-Shiite prejudice among the troops with a catchy slogan favored by the Ayatollah himself. La Sunniya, la Shi'iyya, wahda wahda Islamiyya, the demonstrators chanted. There is no Sunni or Shiite, just Islamic unity. The troops were not swayed. As demonstrators ignored orders to stop, machine guns opened fire at chest level. The first volley was greeted with something close to disbelief. Then, amid cries of horror and the gurgling of the dying, the crowd broke up in chaos. Some ran away. Others tried to pick up the wounded from the pools of blood. With government hospitals refusing to accept the casualties, feverish, often delusional victims were housed in Husseinias, where a few Shiite doctors and nurses provided basic first aid. The unwashed corpses of the dead, and there were at least five of those, were also dragged into the Husseinias and then carried through the streets. The martyrs' blood, which smeared marchers' robes, was meant to convince those not yet demonstrating that staying home was no longer an option. As the guard closed in, troopers were given orders to arrest any man walking alone. This became a high-risk mission. The narrow lanes of Old Qatif made for perfect ambush opportunities against soldiers unfamiliar with the terrain. One by one, guard patrols who wandered too deep into town were attacked by squads of youths armed with knives and iron bars. As troopers were killed, their captured weapons were turned against other guard units. fearing that the Shiite rebellion would spread across the entire eastern province, disrupting the country's oil output. The Saudi government that day sealed all roads into the Shiite heartland around Qatif and severed phone lines. And, just as was the case with the seizure of the Grand Mosque a week earlier, it allowed no hint about these disturbing events in the tightly censored media. Instead, aiming to appease Khomeini, King Khalid sent the Ayatollah a telegram expressing gratitude for Iran's Islamic brotherly position in the Grand Mosque affair. Chapter 23. In the refined splendor of the Élysée Palace in Paris, President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing assembled his senior military aides for a confidential late-morning meeting. Though the operation he would discuss concerned a foreign land, the French foreign minister was not invited, in the interests of maintaining strict secrecy. The stuffed chairs were occupied by the Minister of Defense, Yvan Bourges, the commander of the Gendarmerie Nationale, and by General Navarro, fresh from Riyadh. Though spreading unrest in the Shiite towns of the eastern province had not yet been reported to the general public, French intelligence, just like the CIA, already knew about new troubles facing al-Sa'd. General Navarro painted a somber picture of the kingdom's state of affairs. The Saudi monarchy, he announced, tottered on the brink of collapse. Saudi officials had severely misjudged the extent of resistance that Juhayman's men could offer in Mecca, and as a result, Saudi troops had been mauled in a veritable massacre. The Saudi National Guard no longer wanted to fight in the Grand Mosque. The Americans had tried to help on the ground, and failed. France was the only hope left. It had become the French Republic's responsibility to rescue a monarchy that guaranteed the free world's oil supplies. It was obvious that regular French army troops, even the famed Foreign Legion, were ill-suited for this job. There was no chance of keeping French aid under wraps should they deploy to the vicinity of Mecca. And at such a sensitive moment, any leak about French involvement would inevitably fuel Khomeini's propaganda against the Saudi regime, making the kingdom's position even more precarious. These objections, it was understood, did not apply to a very special unit. The nimble and secretive Groupe d'Intervention de la Gendarmerie Nationale, created after the 1972 debacle at the Munich Olympics, where Palestinian terrorists took hostage and then murdered Israeli athletes. The GIGN was reputed at the time to be Europe's, if not the world's, best-trained special force. Part of the Gendarmerie, a branch of the French military that carries out law enforcement duties, the GIGN had already shown its mettle. In Djibouti, across the Red Sea from Saudi shores, a group of terrorists had seized a bus full of French schoolchildren in 1976. GIGN commandos flown from Paris first persuaded the militants to eat food spiked with tranquilizers, and then, applying the lessons of the Munich fiasco, opened up with a simultaneous barrage of fire that allowed almost all the children to escape unscathed. Senior Saudi princes knew all of this well. Prince Nayef himself had watched the GIGN commandos in action in the spring of 1979 at a military exhibition in the French town of Sattari. The GIGN's officer in charge of the show for the Saudis was the unit's deputy commander, Lieutenant Paul Barille, then 33. A blue-eyed combat diver with a shock of blonde hair and a deceptive babyish smile, he was a third-generation gendarme, raised in an Alpine outpost on the Italian frontier. A rising star in the murky world of anti-terrorism, Barille had joined the GIGN after stints in West Berlin, where he commanded an AMX-13 battle tank, took part in guarding the Nazi war criminal Rudolf Hess, and instructed American soldiers at an inter-Allied training center. In West Berlin, Barille also began dabbling with spy work, making forays across the Berlin Wall to snap pictures of the Soviet zone, and helping Count de Marentsch's SDECE collect and debrief East German defectors who had managed to sneak into the city's French sector. These intelligence ties meant that, despite his lowly rank, the young officer had plenty of friends in the corridors of French power. As a GIGN commando, he had already been sent on top-secret assignments all over the world, from El Salvador to Tahiti. When not on a mission, Barille experimented with the newest weapons and gadgets of his tradecraft at the unit's base in Marsan-Alfort near Paris. he dedicated particular energy to a piece of equipment that was still considered exotic at the time, a Kevlar bulletproof jacket. For Prince Nayef's benefit, Baril's commandos rappelled down from a helicopter, guns blazing. Then the lieutenant unloaded his Magnum 357 into the chest of a fellow trooper who wore a clay saucer on a necklace. The saucer shattered into a thousand pieces, and an odd Prince Nayef was invited to pick out the hot bullets lodged in the grinning trooper's Kevlar vest. The conversation after the show, however, quickly turned sour. Nayef asked Baril whether the French could train Saudi combat divers and commandos to protect the kingdom's oil installations from possible Iranian sabotage. "How well trained are these men already?" Baril inquired. "They are Bedouins. They don't even know how to swim," Prince Nayef replied honestly. "Then it's just impossible. It won't work," the Frenchman scoffed with disdain. Offended by such impudence, Prince Nayef gave the lieutenant a blistering look. But the impressive display of firepower at Sateri remained stuck in his mind. Months later, once Prince Turki's phone call to Count de Morange opened contacts on possible French help in the Mecca affair, the Saudis specifically requested the GIGN. The unit, then numbering just a few dozen gendarmes, was commanded by Captain Christian Proutot, a tall 35-year-old graduate of the elite Saint-Cyr Military Academy. Proutot combined a commando's dedication to martial arts with a more bookish passion for antique watches. To unwind, he played guitar in the GIGN rock band. Proutot was training with his men at Masson-Alfort when he received a summons to the Gendarmerie Nationale headquarters. Baril, promoted to captain since the Sateri show, immediately guessed the reason. "It must be something to do with the trouble in Mecca," he told fellow commandos. He was right. A few hours later, Proutot was whisked into the Élysée Palace by the Gendarmerie chief, and now sat in the august presence of the President of the Republic himself. Formal and impeccably courteous, President Giscard d'Estaing exuded all the inborn confidence of an aristocrat, even though the noble title of d'Estaing, extinct since the French Revolution, had been purchased by the president's bourgeois father only in 1922 in order to improve the provincial family's social standing. A lanky, balding man with an oblong, finely featured face, Giscard d'Estaing didn't say much during the meeting, but when he opened his mouth, his instructions were clear. "Do the maximum possible," he ordered Proutot. The captain responded that his men were ready for action. He had only one concern, how to exfiltrate his team from Saudi Arabia once the operation was over. The need for discretion meant that no French aircraft could be on standby in Mecca, and the nearest French base in the area, in Djibouti, was several hundred kilometers away. These details, he was told, were to be worked out through the chain of command. Back on base in Masson-Alfort, Proutot assembled the unit that would be sent to Saudi Arabia. Though Proutot usually participated himself in most GIGN operations, this time he chose to stay behind. This, he reckoned, would ensure that the commandos wouldn't get abandoned by France should unforeseen complications arise. Baril would be the one actually heading to Arabia. Men of great ambition who now held equal rank, Captains Proutot and Baril maintained an uneasy relationship that would implode in following years. In 1979, however, the hierarchy was clear. Proutot was called by his men Le Grand. Baril's nickname was Le Petit. Two more men were assigned to go to Saudi Arabia with Baril. Warrant Officer Ignace Wadetsky, then 39, was a career gendarme who had supervised Baril's fitness test when the young officer had first joined the GIGN, and, much to Baril's annoyance, made him run a few extra miles. Unlike the dreamy, multilingual Baril, Wadetsky, the son of a Polish coal miner, was a stickler for the rules. This was precisely the reason Proutot wanted him in Saudi Arabia, to provide independent feedback and to keep Baril's impulsiveness in check. The third member of the team was Christian Lambert, a 32-year-old explosive specialist and another veteran of the GIGN. Before his departure for Saudi Arabia, Baril was summoned by Bourges, the Minister of Defense. The minister didn't consider the mission ahead all that difficult. "You have to eject a couple of imbeciles from some grotto," he dismissively told Baril. "All you'll have to do is throw a couple of grenades at them. Child's play." But the commandos prepared for the worst, They simply didn't know what to expect. Intelligence support was so scarce that Pertot had to rip a picture of the Grand Mosque from a news magazine to familiarize himself with the geography of the shrine. Later that day, he called a journalist friend for a quick lecture on Islam. As Pertot brainstormed with Baril, the two officers hit on the same idea of using chemical weapons that, unbeknownst to them, had already been tried by the CIA. "We'll gas them in the basement like rats," Pertot mused. Instead of good old tear gas, the French went for a potent, concentrated, fine powder variety of a chemical called dichlorobenzaldehyde melanonitrile. Known simply as CB to the soldiers, this chemical had already been used by the GIGN in hostage situations in France and abroad. During training at Maisonneuve-4, Baril even experimented with the stuff on himself, almost going blind in the process. Similar to the gas used by Russian troops to free hostages seized by Chechen rebels in a Moscow theater in 2002, in a debacle that caused over 170 deaths, CB is an irritant that blocks respiration and inhibits aggressiveness. Non-lethal if the subject is removed quickly, the concoction, by Baril's calculations, could kill within 5 minutes if only 0.3 milligrams are present per cubic meter of confined space. The French powder had an active agent concentration of nearly 100%, compared with the 30% or less for tear gas usually used in riot control. The three Frenchmen packed a small amount of CB and dispensers, gas masks, and flak jackets. Carrying this gear, they arrived before dawn of Thursday, November 29th, at the Villecouvelet Military Airport near Paris. There, at 6 a.m., they boarded a Mystere 20 executive jet that was usually used by senior government officials. General Navarreau traveled with the GIGN men, explaining during the flight the intricacies of Al-Saud's current predicament. The word Mecca never appeared in the government's paperwork. Instead, the Gendarmerie Nationale Travel Order No. 3016 dispatched Baril, Wodecki, and Lambert on a provost mission to Saudi Arabia, destination Riyadh. The jet stopped for refueling in Larnaca, Cyprus, and landed in the Saudi capital at about 6 p.m. There, French commandos were driven straight from the airport to a meeting of the Saudi General Staff. The city looked tense and deserted. Inside the palace that housed Saudi generals, everything suggested revolutionary times. Edgy troops with large machine guns facing in all directions camped on garish carpets, in a mood of deepening gloom and suspicion. As he walked through, Baril whispered to a colleague that should someone discharge a weapon by accident, the Saudi military command would most likely be instantly decimated in jittery crossfire. Once he presented himself to the pot-bellied Saudi generals, Baril asked who these rebels in Mecca actually were. To his surprise, the Saudis told him they didn't know. Then it was their turn to gasp. The Saudis had been expecting a somewhat larger force and appeared shocked once Baril explained to them that the French mission consisted of just him and two other men. The French commandos, accompanied by a military attaché, were assured that a senior Saudi general, possibly even the Mecca governor, Prince Fawaz, would meet them on the ground. Then they were driven back to the airport, where a large transport plane had already started the engines. From this point, the mission went under deep cover. To maintain the secret of their true identities, Baril and his men had to surrender their passports and military papers to the French embassy staff. Dressed in civilian clothes, Baril sported bell-bottom jeans with a cowboy belt, they no longer had weapons for personal protection and had no way of communicating with their superiors except for the unreliable Saudi telephone system. To the outsiders, they were supposed to be three French businessmen, albeit a bit too muscular and broad-shouldered to make the story entirely convincing. Reassuringly, the plane taking them from Riyadh had an American crew, who exchanged friendly banter with the French during the flight. It was near midnight when the commandos finally arrived at the Taif military airport. There were no generals and no princes to greet them. After a while, a low-level Saudi officer emerged to welcome the French commandos. He drove them to their rooms, not in the Saudi barracks, but in Taif's marble and glass Intercontinental Hotel. The following morning, the GIGN commandos were assigned a guide, a major of the Saudi Armored Corps who had studied in France and spoke fluent French. They retrieved their gear from the airfield and, in a white Peugeot GL provided by their Saudi hosts, headed to a secluded villa where training sessions for Saudi troops would begin. The first of these meetings was in a bare classroom, with a blackboard, battered chairs, and a framed picture of the Grand Mosque on the wall. The French were stunned by just how demoralized the Saudi officers seemed to be. Some were bandaged after sustaining light wounds. Others shared stories of how their comrades had fallen under rebel fire. Everyone appeared reluctant to return to the battlefield. Baria realized it would be extremely hard to persuade these men to head down the mosque's dark, dank staircases into the basement where Juhayman's men, invisible from above, shot without missing. One officer's helmet, pierced by a bullet, was a vivid reminder of the dangers. The man had worn this helmet on the hip when it was struck, at the staircase to the mosque's basement. The very same bullet had burst through the chests of two other Saudi troopers. They didn't survive. To raise morale, Baril and the other two commandos started teaching the Saudis about flak jackets. While these were initially designed to protect against flak, fragments of an exploding shell or hand grenade, newer versions used by the French at the time were also supposed to stop bullets. To make his point, Baril hung one of these jackets on the wall and unloaded a gun into the chest plate area. Unlike at the demonstration for Saudi princes at the arms show, he didn't risk performing this experiment with one of his own men actually wearing the gear. This was wise. Though they shielded their wearers from magnum pistol shots, the French vests, it turned out, provided only limited protection against high-velocity 7.62 and 5.56mm assault rifle bullets of the kind fired by the rebels in Mecca. Employed in action in following days, the vests would come back riddled with blood-stained holes. The Saudis briefed the French about what had been attempted in Mecca in previous days. They told the GIGN's men about the carbonized APCs, about the failure of tear gas attacks, and about the dogged determination of Juhayman's rebels. The very topography of the Kabu labyrinths seemed to be protecting the militants, limiting the damage inflicted by government attacks to just a few rooms. Now it appeared that the Saudis had run out of options and simply didn't know what to do. In this atmosphere of chaotic improvisation, not even a map of the area was on hand. Trying to understand the layout of the shrine, Baril plucked the framed picture of the Grand Mosque from the wall. Without a second thought, he then started to mark on it possible approaches to the basement. A groan of shock went through the room. Saudi troopers were aghast at such a blasphemous use of sacred imagery. For the next session, they fetched more detailed plans that Salem bin Laden and Angawi had provided in the initial days of the siege. At lunch, Baril examined his Saudi-issued food ration. Unlike the most illiterate Saudi troopers, he noticed that the ration pack was long expired, as one could expect in a country where defense contracts were designed to provide maximum kickback opportunities for senior princes. It became clear to the French gendarmes that day that the Saudis lacked basic concepts of military planning. Attacks in Mecca so far were mostly frontal, without any concern for casualties. Saudi officers became visibly animated, exchanging excited murmurs, once Baril suggested making a diversionary strike in one part of the basement and sending the main thrust of the troops through a different area. Such concepts, part of Tactics 101 in any war college, seemed a total novelty, French commandos concluded with unease. Baril expected that he would soon be heading to the Grand Mosque himself to supervise the planned operation firsthand. Some of the Saudi officers seemed to think so, too. "You know you have to convert to Islam if you want to go to Mecca," one of the officers in charge told him. Baril, raised a Catholic in a village of regular churchgoers, knew very little about Islam at the time. But he didn't think long before replying. He was ready to convert if this was necessary to get the job done. After all, Baril figured, it was common for the GIGN commandos to assume other identities during operations. They posed as stewards in plane rescues, or as prison guards while quelling jailhouse riots. What would be the difference between wearing a steward's uniform and pledging allegiance to Islam? After the first day in Taif, Baril grew convinced that the material he had brought from France was insufficient. GIGN commandos needed to equip and train several hundred men, and quickly. Back in his room in the Taif Intercontinental, the captain wrote a long wish list and then called Pruteau. Baril told his commander that he wanted more flak jackets, grenades, sniper rifles, field radios, night vision goggles, and gas masks. And, most important, he needed CB. A ton of it. Literally. Pruteau thought he misheard when Brill first named the staggering amount. 1 ton of CB was, after all, enough to poison an entire city. But Brill wasn't joking. The precariousness of the Saudi regime, he insisted, should not be underestimated by Paris. Pruteau immediately went to work putting together this mammoth shipment. In the French military bureaucracy, the sheer size of Baril's request prompted snickering suggestions that the captain must have succumbed to panic. Some of his demands, after all, exceeded the French military's entire stockpile. Baril, who understood the difference of perceptions between Taif and Paris, remained glued to a phone in a parallel effort to convince key French officials that this equipment was really needed. His army friend from common service in West Berlin now commanded the presidential guard in the Élysée Palace. Brill used this friendship to make sure that President Giscard d'Estaing was personally briefed about the gravity of the situation in Mecca. Shortly after this phone call, the French were driven to a military compound where they were supposed to train a different batch of soldiers. When their Peugeot rolled into the base, the French-speaking Saudi major who accompanied the GIGN men grew inexplicably tense. He parked the car in an isolated area, far away from the main barracks, and then told the French to remain seated. Half an hour later, the major returned, turned the ignition key, and hurriedly drove his charges away. It was too dangerous to stay there, he explained. Considering the rotten morale in the Saudi forces and the doubtful loyalty of some units, it was anyone's guess what reaction a presence of Western personnel might provoke. The French realized that they might be in grave danger, and that they had no way of protecting themselves. Who are our friends here? Warrant Officer Wodecki wondered. Who are our enemies? Chapter 24. The French were working on plans for seizing the Grand Mosque's basement-level galleries, just as violence in the Shiite eastern province reached a fever pitch. The situation had gotten so desperate that Secretary of State Vance sent Ambassador West a long cable on November 29th, instructing him to begin preparations for a possible evacuation of American citizens from the kingdom. Appalled, Ambassador West replied that if the Americans indeed evacuated from Saudi Arabia, it would wreck the armed forces, oil production, transportation, etc., and would lead to the overthrow of the Saud regime. In any case, he informed the State Department, Prince Bandar had assured him that the Saudis were confident of crushing the Shiite uprising, as long as Washington didn't complain too much about human rights violations. The Iranian lesson had been learned, and no such complaints were forthcoming. On November 29th, the eve of the Ashura holiday, the final battle erupted in the Shiite hub of Qatif. The National Guard, harassed since the previous night in the downtown maze, initially withdrew to the town's outskirts. Several military vehicles were set ablaze overnight. Shiite rioters, just like Juhayman's men in Mecca, had discovered the art of Molotov cocktails, hurling them at passing military vehicles from rooftops and upstairs windows. The morning began with the burials of youngsters who had been gunned down the previous day. Angry sermons at the cemetery sent crowds of men, armed with sticks, rocks, and crowbars, to the town's main square. Like Juhayman in Mecca, these demonstrators, no longer satisfied with simply affirming Shiite rights, now openly demanded an end to the monarchy. Entranced by the apparent strength of their numbers, they chanted, "Death to Saud," and, "With our spirit and our blood, we'll redeem you, Islam." Then they turned their rage on the symbols of the Saudi state and its Western allies. The first targets were the local branches of the Riyadh Bank and the Saudi British Bank. The police guards there tried to offer resistance, but they were quickly overpowered by the crowd. One man was shot in the attack. Having ransacked the two banks, the crowds surged to another building housing the Arab Bank, which was also looted. Then the tumble-down amusement park of the city was set alight. Condemned by Islamic revolutionaries for supposedly undermining public morals and distracting the townsfolk from their noble struggle, the mobs, demolishing everything in their way, continued to the local courthouse and the offices of Saudi Airlines. In the mid-morning, National Guard troopers returned. Dispersing death from mounted machine guns, they drove back the rioters, recapturing sections of the downtown. Some revolutionaries attempted a last-ditch resistance from the Qatif Water Tower, which, like the minarets in Mecca, provided a high ground position for snipers. but the Shiites had only limited military training and were quickly dislodged. By the afternoon, helicopter gunships hovered in the sky, strafing anyone seen moving in the streets of Qatif. Electricity and water were cut off, in addition to the severing of telephone links the previous day. Frightening the locals, heavy artillery was deployed around the town in the afternoon, ready to pulverize Qatif, if need be. The day was just as dramatic in the town of Safwa, separated from Qatif by a patch of desert crisscrossed by thick Aramco pipelines. A native of the town had been killed in the previous day's demonstrations in Qatif. Following the funeral, the morning of November 29th, a discussion broke out among younger revolutionaries and the town elders. The hotheads wanted to march toward the police station. "Let's go ask them. Why did they kill our man?" they urged. The elders warned against any rash moves. "They will not hesitate to kill you, too, if you give them a chance," one argued. But passions were too inflamed for such caution. By the late morning, a burgeoning human mass spilled from the cemetery into Safwa's main street, and then blocked the coastal highway connecting the Dammam Tahran Al-Kobar conurbation with the giant oil refinery complex and oil export terminal at Ras Tanura, farther up the coast. The town's police station stood on that road, named after Prophet Muhammad's son-in-law Ali, so revered by the Shiites. That was where the demonstrators now headed. As they approached within a few blocks, the National Guard suddenly opened fire, prompting a chaotic retreat by hundreds of frightened demonstrators. Once again, bodies fell on the ground in the final convulsions of death. The wounded, often delirious, were brought into Husaniya's, and helicopter gunships appeared in the sky. Advancing into town behind armored cars, guardsmen shot at anything that moved as frightened residents shivered indoors. By the time Ashura arrived on Friday, November 30th, it was clear that, though sporadic violence in the area would continue for years, the Saudi Shiite uprising was by and large suppressed. Nearly 20 Shiite demonstrators and several government troops had been killed, and Shiite towns were wrecked by the violence. Lacking weapons or training, the young Shiite revolutionaries realized that they were no match for the National Guard. "What are you going to fight them with? Your sandals?" an 18-year-old protester who had agitated for a march towards Safwa's police station, Hamza Hassan, was scolded by his grandfather that night. Police and National Guard blocked all the roads, isolating the Shiite heartland from key oil industry installations. Police even seized, in the security sweep, an Aramco oil company bus with some 40 employees that happened to be driving near Qatif. It took a high-level intervention by the oil company to have its workers released. The older generation Shiite community leaders, ostracized as sellouts in the first days of the uprising, now felt able to sue for peace with authorities. The king's brother and the Saudi Deputy Minister of Interior, Prince Ahmed, flew to the eastern province in these hours and received in the Dammam Governor's Building a delegation of Shiite sheikhs, prominent merchants, and moderate clerics. Prince Ahmed began the meeting by demanding the return of 5 large-caliber weapons that had been captured by rebels from government forces. But he wasn't interested in escalating the confrontation. Minutes later, Prince Ahmed listened with concern as prominent Shiite businessman Abdullah Matroud and other notables voiced their grievances at the lack of job opportunities and social services in towns like Qatif. Somewhat apologetically, the prince replied with a promise to take up the matter with King Khalid as soon as he returned to Riyadh. The government wouldn't just direct money to relieve Shiite poverty, Prince Ahmed said. Should calm be restored, some restrictions on Shiite religious practices would also be lifted. The House of Saud couldn't afford to be vengeful. After all, the royal family still had to deal with another security nightmare, Juhayman's gunmen, who remained holed up in the basement of the Grand Mosque. In the wider Muslim world, meanwhile, the ripples of anti-American anger unleashed by the Holy Shrine's seizure 10 days earlier continued to spread. A major Kuwaiti newspaper, Al-Siyasa, relayed for the first time to the general Arab public the details of Juhayman's ideology. The newspaper obtained a copy of the 7 epistles and, in the November 29th edition, dedicated prime space to key extracts, including the Saudi rebels' denunciation of the presence of embassies of Christian states. This touched a raw nerve among American diplomats. Of most obvious and immediate concern is the teaching against embassies in our lands, the U.S. ambassador in Kuwait commented in an immediate telegram to the State Department that outlined Al-Siyasi's article. The extent to which propaganda of this kind have been propagated in Kuwait is unknown to us. The answer came the following day, November 30th. Inspired by the destruction of the U.S. embassy in Pakistan and assaults on American interests in Turkey, India, and Bangladesh, a mob of Kuwaiti radicals converged near the U.S. embassy there and tried to break in. Kuwaiti troops had to use tear gas and flashbang grenades to disperse the rioters. 2 days later, it was the turn of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. The American embassy there, on a quiet side street in the central part of the city, was already operating with skeleton staff, a result of growing hostility between the Carter administration and Libya's firebrand military dictator, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Following a downgrading of ties, the United States no longer had a full ambassador in Libya and was represented by a chargé d'affaires, William Eagleton. State Department officials didn't seem unduly worried by Gaddafi's refusal to let a customary U.S. Marine unit deploy on embassy grounds. Attack wasn't deemed imminent. After all, President Carter's brother, Billy, had just spent a month touring Libya and would soon become its paid lobbyist. Responding to a letter sent by President Carter the previous week, Gaddafi assured the United States that its mission in Tripoli was safe from any harm. In the absence of Marines, security duties fell on the CIA station chief in Tripoli, Jack McCabot. He wasn't as sanguine. After the hostage-taking in Tehran, the Mecca uprising, and the bloodshed in Islamabad, the spy grew convinced that it was just a matter of time before a similar assault was made on Americans in Libya. First, he destroyed or pouched to Tunis sensitive documents, lest they fall into the wrong hands, as had happened in Tehran. Then, late at night, McCabot drove to a cliff and threw into the sea his cameras and other incriminating tools of spycraft. He searched for ways to defend the embassy from an attack that he now expected any time. In the embassy basement, McCabot and one of the diplomats, a former Marine, found a treasure trove. Canisters containing a mixture of tear gas and a potent nauseating agent, and coils of razor wire. The wire was immediately used to bar access to the embassy roof. The gas canisters were brought up to prepare an unpleasant surprise for the anticipated invaders. Early in the morning of Sunday, December 2nd, a working day on the Islamic calendar, a Libyan contact approached McCabot with a warning. The man's children, students in a high school, had told him to stay away from the American embassy that day because it was going to be burned down on orders from above. McCabot ran to inform the chargé, Eagleton, and the embassy staff braced for the attack. The visa section was closed, and all female employees except one were sent home. Only about a dozen Americans remained indoors, tear gas grenades and gas masks at the ready. Dressed in suits and ties, McCabot and an embassy political officer, Jim Hooper, went outdoors for a look at around 9 a.m. Students, clad in paramilitary attire, already thronged the streets. The two Americans followed one such group all the way to Tripoli's huge Al-Saha Al-Qadra Square. There, their jaws dropped. The square was teeming with thousands of youngsters. Many waved banners proclaiming solidarity with Iranian students who had occupied the U.S. embassy in Tehran and calling for the downfall of American imperialism. At that moment, McCabot realized that there was only one place for all those youngsters to go, the American embassy. It also suddenly dawned on him just how conspicuous he and Hooper were with their ties and suits on this square, like FBI agents at a peace march. Back at the embassy, everything still seemed surprisingly calm. An elderly Libyan policeman slept in his chair near the building, caressed by the morning sun. The mob arrived 20 minutes later. Diplomats trapped inside first heard the roaring sound of chanting, "Death to America! Death to America!" Then the battering ram started working on the front gate. Students outside also started burning effigies of the Iranian Shah and of the Egyptian President Sadat, who, as the official radio helpfully explained during the protest, was in collusion with the butchers and executioners of peoples, the United States. Then the turn came to set ablaze the American flag and an effigy of Carter himself. As the battering continued, McCabot instructed all Americans to don their gas masks, pulled the safety pin of the tear gas grenade, and threw it into the main entryway. The grenade fell down clanking. Then, nothing happened. Now, McCabot was seriously worried. Nobody knew just how long these grenades had been lying in the embassy basement. What if none of them worked? He pulled another safety pin and threw down a second grenade. This one went off, emitting a cloud of gas. Encouraged, McCabot lobbed the rest of the grenades, one by one, saturating the lower floor, and retreated to higher ground. As planned beforehand, embassy employees then poured motor oil on the marble staircases. It was time to escape. Unlike the isolated embassy in Pakistan, the one in Libya had the benefit of being part of an O-shaped block of apartment buildings. The embassy's back door led to the courtyard inside the O. Across this courtyard was the back door of an apartment that had long been rented by the embassy and that allowed an exit to a busy street around the corner from the main entrance. Coincidentally, it was Mark Hambly, the political officer now in Saudi Arabia, who had prepared this escape plan while previously posted in Libya. Hurrying safely across the courtyard, the Americans opened the escape door and were shocked to see that the main thoroughfare was clogged with green-clad teenagers, the overflow of the main column now busily breaking into the embassy. At that moment, a Libyan janitor, who knew the diplomat's affiliation, walked through the building's hallway, smiling enigmatically, and headed outside toward the crowd of demonstrators. McCabot briefly considered capturing the man and keeping him in the apartment, but then thought it too complicated. Without wasting time, he decided to divide the trapped Americans into smaller groups. Men were told to remove jackets and ties and walk through the crowd casually, without running or displaying anxiety. They were all to avoid eye contact with rioters and to gather in the British Embassy. McCabot himself left in the last group, with Hooper and the one woman, a secretary. As he walked through hostile stairs, he heard some of the youngsters on the street exchanging puzzled comments and wondering aloud whether these three foreigners in the middle of a riot could be American. But none of the mob leaders were here, around the corner from the main action, and without orders from above, the suspicious students didn't dare take the initiative. McCabot and his two companions were allowed to walk away undisturbed. Once Libyan students overran the embassy, they were in for a shock. Thick clouds of tear gas they encountered in the lobby prompted spells of retching and pain. Overwhelmed by the chemicals, some students tried to run up the stairs. Inevitably, they slipped on the motor oil that had been generously poured around, and they tumbled down the marble steps and the banisters, rolling onto the heads of fellow protesters. As some of the more excited ones ran outside, screaming that they had been gassed, the crowd rushed away, trampling some of the teenagers. Libya's official Jamahiriya news agency that afternoon issued a whining report about American perfidy. Upon the students breaking into the embassy, the staff fired toxic gases believed to be used only by the military, confirming that the embassy employees are military personnel, the Libyan mouthpiece complained. The use of toxic gases by U.S. embassy personnel resulted in the injury of several Libyan students who were carried to the hospital in serious condition. Of course, not just students entered the embassy. Libyan military intelligence officers also arrived in the building and were spotted carting away boxloads of documents. None of these contained classified information. Riches pillaged by Libyan intelligence included all 11 volumes of the State Department's publicly accessible Foreign Service Regulations, the embassy's Learn a Foreign Language tapes in Italian, and the cashier's records documenting petty cash foreign currency exchanges by the staff. The following day, just after embassy personnel managed to reattach the dislodged front door, a young Libyan man arrived and started pounding at the entrance. One of the rioters who attacked the building the previous day, he surveyed the damage with glee, proud of a job well done. Then he told McCabot he needed a visa to return to a college he was attending in upstate New York. Once McCabot slammed the door with a curse, the flustered Libyan started screaming in English, "You can't do this to me!" Chapter 25. As rioters rampaged in the American embassy in Tripoli on Sunday, December 2nd, a French Caravelle jet landed in Saudi Arabia. The aircraft, which once ferried President Charles de Gaulle, had had its seats stripped out to make more room for 7 tons of cargo. La Société Nationale de Poudre et d'Explosifs, which manufactured CB, had not been able to satisfy Barillo's request for the toxic concoction in full. Only 300 kilograms of the chemical, the entire available stock, were aboard the caravel, along with gas masks, hand grenades, gas dispensers, and 150 flak jackets. Captain Pruteau, the GIGN commander who had supervised the loading of this gear in France, chose not to tell the pilots exactly what they transported. The airmen, he figured, might have balked at flying potentially lethal chemicals. In a small breach of the rules, Pruteau also placed on board a small gift that his men would greatly appreciate in dry Saudi Arabia, a box of Sauvignon. This particular wine had been bottled in 1974, the year of the GIGN's creation. "Good luck," Pruteau scribbled in an enclosed note to Barillo, Wodetsky, and Lambert. "But be careful. Remember, this is not your war." In a mishap that could have caused a major problem, one of these bottles broke during unloading, leaking its precious liquid all over the tarmac of the Taif airbase. Saudi officers who supervised the operation either didn't realize this was wine, or, being pragmatic, pretended not to notice such a flagrant violation of Saudi Arabia's prohibition on alcohol. In addition to the Sauvignon, the three French commandos managed to pilfer from the plane and bring to their intercontinental rooms a few hand grenades, as extra insurance should events spin out of control. Once the French supplies were transferred down the road to Mecca, Barillo rehearsed with Saudi officers the final details of the planned assault. The French captain desperately wanted to travel to Mecca himself to help direct this carefully choreographed operation firsthand. Some of the Saudi officers also wanted him there. The Grand Mosque, after all, was just a few minutes' ride by helicopter from Taif. But penetrating the holy city, thus violating a taboo on visits by infidels, was against instructions given by Paris. Worrying that Barillo might disobey these orders, Lambert phoned Pruteau in Paris. "The captain is having all these wild ideas," he warned the GIGN commander. Pruteau was furious. He gave Barillo a tongue-lashing over the phone and then spoke to Lambert again. The other two commandos, he said, should keep a close eye on their captain. Pruteau left Lambert with an instruction should Barillo persist in attempting to enter Mecca. "Go ahead and lock him up in the room." In spite of this prohibition, Barillo, by his own account, briefly sneaked into the Holy City and into the Grand Mosque itself before the attack on the compound began. Some U.S. officials concur with his version. Barillo's two comrades in arms and Pruteau, however, are adamant that this never happened. The French role in the Mecca affair, they insist, was strictly limited to providing equipment and training in Taif and its vicinity. According to them, neither Barillo nor any other French soldiers set foot on Mecca's sacred ground during the siege. Even if the French captain did visit Mecca during the crisis, it was in a strictly advisory capacity. No French commandos engaged in actual combat on Saudi soil. When the final push into the Kaaba began the morning of December 3rd, the GIGN troopers were holed up in their Taif hotel rooms. It would be hours before they received the first news from the battlefield. Implementing the French-drafted plan on Monday morning, crews of workers, many of them civilian Pakistanis or Turks, started to drill perforations in the thick floor of the mosque. Soon, an O-shaped ring of boreholes around the enclosure connected the surface with the underground labyrinth. These openings were supposed to be broad enough for the CB canisters to pass through, but not sufficiently large for the rebels to use as escape hatches. As soon as the drills were pulled from the holes, Juhayman's rebels, who patiently waited below, unseen in the darkness, obtained a clear line of fire toward the workmen above. Short, well-aimed fountains of bullets from these perforations were as lethal as they were unexpected. Several workmen fell dead, their blood gathering in pools and starting to drip into the boreholes. Clad in French-supplied gas masks and chemical suits, Saudi soldiers fired through these perforations canisters of CB wired with explosives. Since the radio systems of various units were not compatible, soldiers had been ordered to pull the triggers of CB launchers at the sound of the first detonation. A near simultaneous series of blasts thundered in a circle around the Grand Mosque's courtyard, stunning the rebels trapped underneath in a cloud of powerful toxins. Attempting to saturate the basement, Saudi forces reinforced this initial shower of CB with regular tear gas and grenades. As expected, the potent chemicals momentarily disabled the rebels, allowing the attack teams to burst through the barricades and barbed wire fortifications that Juhayman's holdouts had erected on ramps and staircases. The main thrust of this invasion concentrated on the ramp that led down from the Peace Gate area of the Marwa Safa Gallery, the area where so much blood had been spilled in the early days of the fighting. Pouring into this breach, the bulk of the assault force rushed in a counterclockwise direction toward the Umra Gate on the northwestern side of the compound, and then south toward the King Abdulaziz Gate. A smaller part of the force headed the opposite way, moving clockwise to meet up with fellow soldiers after completing the circle under the Safa Gate and Jihad Gate areas. As they descended into the Kabu, about 100 soldiers with motor-powered CB spraying devices pumped rising clouds of gas into the narrow passageways. Closely behind them advanced 3 additional units, numbering 60 men each, and armed with machine guns and flashbang grenades. These soldiers took no chances, riddling the corridors ahead with salvos of bullets and lobbing grenades before turning a corner. Along the way, they searched and secured room after room. Anyone found alive in these rooms was handed over to 2 arrest teams, which followed behind and numbered more than 40 soldiers. Additional interception teams, with about 10 men each, were posted at all exits from the basement within 3 minutes of the operation's beginning, catching any rebel attempting escape. With a choking chemical mist filling the basement, Juhayman ordered his fighting men to redeploy away from the rooms occupied by the wounded, the hostages, and the women and children. He and his closest aides retreated into the depths of the Kabu to mount their final battle against the miscreant servants of Al-Saud. As the soldiers advanced, they found many hostages still alive, including the wounded paratrooper who had unsuccessfully tried to escape almost a week earlier, and members of the Grand Mosque's police force. Emaciated and often knocked down by gas, these captives hadn't eaten anything for days. Some had had to resort to drinking their own urine. They were lucky to have survived this ordeal. Though standing orders called on Saudi soldiers to give anyone in the mosque, rebel or not, a chance to surrender, in reality, the Kabu was a free fire zone. Their visibility limited by foggy gas masks, the threat of sudden death lurking behind every corner. Jittery Saudi troopers instinctively fired at anything that moved in the forbidding darkness. Uncounted civilians were gunned down by mistake in these final hours of combat. With passageways between some rooms of the Kabu only 90 centimeters, 3 feet high, soldiers had to crawl in the clammy, foul underground. In some areas, they waded knee-deep in putrid, stagnant water. Juhayman's men had pulled out all electric wiring, and so lines of cable had to be rolled behind troops to power floodlights and communications equipment. Adding to the gas, thick black smoke from car tires that the rebels had set alight quickly enveloped the cellars, making it hard to see anything even with military flashlights. It had gotten so hot from the fires that the blades of ceiling fans in parts of the Kabu curled up, taking the shape of giant tulip petals. As effects of the French chemicals began to wear off, Juhayman's men recovered from the initial shock, putting up ferocious resistance in some parts of the basement. Hiding under false floors, they even managed to ambush a part of the advancing government force. Springing up from trapdoors, these small clusters of rebels unloaded their guns point-blank into the troopers, briefly taking some hostages. Soldiers kept dying in the Kabu until the last minutes of the fight. Though Saudi forces regularly used bullhorns to urge Juhayman's gunmen to give up, nobody on the rebel side accepted this call in these hours. "All our prisoners, we captured them," General Dahiri, the operations commander, later said. No one surrendered on his own. 18 hours after the last assault on the Kabu began, the 2 main military forces finally sealed the circle under the mosque, meeting up, as planned, in the King Abdulaziz Gate area. It had been precisely 2 weeks since the start of the Mecca uprising. Just before dawn on Tuesday, December 4th, 1979, the official Saudi press agency sent around the world a celebratory statement from Prince Nayef. "With God's help," the interior minister announced, "the purge of all members of the corrupt gang of renegades from the basement of the Grand Mosque was completed at 01:30 this morning." The Saudis, however, were once again getting ahead of themselves. Eugene Bovis, the chief political officer at the American Embassy, sought more information in the early afternoon of that Tuesday from a senior Saudi foreign ministry official, Abbas Ghazawi. Despite Prince Nayef's early morning announcement, Ghazawi said frankly, there were still two roomfuls of gunmen holding out in the basement. Juhayman, Saudi authorities believed at the time, had escaped. By nightfall, a paratroops unit led by Captain Abu Sultan, the French-trained grandson of the former chief of the Grand Mosque Police, finished the mopping up in its sector of the Kabu and reached the metal door to the only room not yet secured. The captain ordered his troops to wire explosives to the door and blow it open. Once the soldiers burst inside, they spotted more than a dozen men hunched by the stone walls, their faces covered by soot, their tattered gowns soiled by blood and vomit. Some shook uncontrollably, but one, while visibly exhausted after days of fighting, retained an unbending, fierce look. This man, older than the others, had tangled hair and a long, disheveled beard. Nearby were crates of weapons, barrels of Labneh cheese, bowls of dates, and piles of leaflets. "What is your name?" Abu Sultan asked, pointing his gun at the man. "Juhayman," he answered softly. Abu Sultan already knew from interrogations of other detainees that this was the name of the rebel ringleader. He had caught the big prize. The captain's immediate concern was that Juhayman, whose gunman had killed so many government soldiers, would be lynched or shot dead before even leaving the mosque. Mobs of triumphant soldiers were already setting on prisoners who emerged from the basement, kicking them down and venting all the frustrations accumulated in the past 2 weeks of warfare. It was with great difficulty that security squads managed to drag off these bloodied, half-dead detainees. To spare Juhayman such a fate, Abu Sultan escorted the rebel leader, sandwiched between two officers, to the surface, and then immediately hid him in an ambulance parked nearby. The ambulance then sped out of the mosque and delivered the prisoner to the Mecca Hotel, where senior princes now assembled. Along the way, one of Abu Sultan's men asked Juhayman with disgust, "How could you do all this? How could you?" The rebel was unrepentant. Without showing emotion, he murmured his reply. "This was God's will." A courtyard outside the Mecca Hotel by now became an open-air detention facility for the captured rebels. Manacled, they were made to sit on the ground, occasionally being slapped or shoved by the troops. Some were bleeding from their wounds. One man's blackened, gangrenous limb exuded a dizzying stench. He was soon taken away by an ambulance. Samir, the teenage brother of two key rebels, was also brought into this courtyard. He and a dozen other non-fighters had been hiding behind a wall in the Kabu and had evaded capture when the troops first entered the area. They were caught hours later as they groped their way out of the basement. A Saudi TV crew and official photographers were brought in to film the trophy shots for the evening news. Some prisoners defiantly looked into the cameras, with one even sticking out his tongue and making a face. Faisal Mohammed Faisal was notable for his air of complete, inconsolable despair and regret. Juhayman was taken across this courtyard and into an area occupied by Prince Nayef and other senior members of the royal household. A soldier dragged the rebel leader by his beard, Arabia's ultimate gesture of disrespect. Seeing this, one of the princes shouted at the soldier to let go. Then Prince Nayef pulled out an old passport-sized picture of Juhayman. The rebel leader now had only a passing likeness to the man in the photograph. "Do you know who this is?" Prince Nayef asked. "It is me. I am Juhayman," was the reply. "You don't have to be asking the others." As Juhayman was led away, one of the officers asked him again why he had desecrated the holiest shrine. The reality of utter defeat began to sink in. "If I had known it would turn out this way, I wouldn't have done it," Juhayman muttered in response. As princes and senior commanders celebrated their costly, bloody victory in Mecca, the only mystery that remained was the fate of the supposed Mahdi, Muhammad Abdullah. Had he managed to escape to fight another day? This riddle was solved soon. Throughout the siege of the Grand Mosque, killed soldiers had been brought to a hospital morgue near the shrine. Officers from every unit involved in the fighting regularly inspected these rows of stiff, bullet-ridden bodies, identifying their own and taking them away for burial. Now that the fighting was over, one cadaver remained in the morgue, still unclaimed. The dead man wore two bandoliers across his chest, in the fashion of National Guard troopers. Puzzling over who this might be, some officers noticed the distinctive red birthmark on his right cheek. Wasn't this supposed to be the sign of the Mahdi? Captives shown the body confirmed. This was indeed Muhammad Abdullah. The corpse was only beginning to decompose, which meant that the rebel had survived for days after the grenade explosion shredded his lower extremities. For the Saudi authorities, a dead Mahdi was the ultimate prize. With this precious cadaver, they held unassailable theological proof that Juhayman's entire enterprise had been based on error, deception, and lies.